Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday. Always appreciative and grateful. So lots to do on the program today. We're going to be talking a little bit about Jeff Bezos, the honcho there at Amazon, and how he's got these plans to go to the moon and what that means. And my friends, the future is now. So we're going to be talking about that. We're also going to be talking about this federal raid that happened at Caterpillar just recently. So we're going to be talking about that. And then we're going to be taking a look at the business side of Northwestern's basketball team. Not the sports side, but the business side. We're going to be talking about that because there's a lot to discuss there. There's a lot of changes and a lot of considerations there. So, however, kicking things off, we have joining us now Sarah McBride, who is a reporter at Bloomberg, who wrote very recently there in Bloomberg, which you can find on their website, all about how Google tried to make Kansas City this sort of, you know, this sort of tech haven and make it the Silicon Valley part two. And then we didn't hear much about it after that. So welcome to the program, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate having you here very much. Well, so tell us about this, because it seemed like all we could talk about there for a while was this story around like 2012, early 2013. So much was being said about this and this, you know, super fast connectivity that this town would have. And it seemed like a lot of people moved there, and then it got very quiet. So what's been happening there?
Right. So Google announced in 2011 that it was going to give Kansas City the chance to be the first city in the nation to have this super high-speed internet. And people got very excited about it and thought that it would jumpstart Kansas City in all kinds of ways. And first they were talking about Kansas City, Kansas, and then they added Kansas City, Missouri. So it was both sides of the border. And people thought that their startup scene would take off, that it would be great for schools and education. And I decided to take a look at, did it really help the startup community in Kansas City? Because you think for technology, having that gigabit speed, just amazingly fast internet would be very helpful.
Right. And it was all around Google Fiber, which was, you know, really touted as this just lightning speed kind of internet and connectivity. And and I remember seeing all of these, businesses, particularly small to mid-sized businesses, talking about, you know, this will be game changing for our business. We're relocating there from far away, not just, you know, near there, but from far distances, too. And then, so what happened once all these entrepreneurs arrive, the fast Google Fiber is there, then what occurs?
Right. Well, people were so excited about it. At the time, the chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, was saying he was more excited about the internet, the fiber internet, than he was about self-driving cars. People moved in from New York, from Florida to start businesses. And then it just turned out that having super high-speed internet was nice, but it wasn't really a game-changer when it came to business. I talked to a lot of startups who said, yeah, we liked being able to download and upload things really fast, but what can you do with that, particularly when your customers don't also have that same super high internet speed? I talked to one guy who had a search engine, and he said that they were literally goofing around with ideas like, oh, let's make our search results all high def, Netflix streaming movies, four or five at once. You know, they were kind of kidding because who'd want a search result like that?
Right.
I really only found one business that was helped by having that kind of internet, and it was a photography business. It's still around. It's actually very promising, and the owner has to upload and download hundreds of high-resolution photographs of sports events. So for him, it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can see why it would be the case. So in Google's plan to make Kansas City area to be this second Silicon Valley, what elements do they need?
To be clear, they didn't plan, okay, we're going to make it a second Silicon Valley. Their plan was, hey, Kansas City, we're going to give you this super high-speed internet, and it's a great opportunity for you. And they did say executives talked about how it would help different parts of the economy, including startups. But their plan was more, we'll give you the infrastructure, and then you just run and go with it. And then Kansas City itself had really high hopes, and they did everything you honestly could to leverage an asset like that. They got city leaders in government together with city leaders in business. They made all sorts of plans. There's a tax credit in Kansas for startups that people were considering cutting, and they said, no, we shouldn't cut it at this time because we have a real opportunity to be a startup center. They created these events for entrepreneurs. The startup community sprang up in one neighborhood that's on both sides of the border, Hanover Heights, and it became known as Startup Village. So really, they did everything right. And I think it was a case of misplaced expectations. Just because you get a helpful asset doesn't mean you have everything in place to become a startup center. And it turns out that what they really needed, things like much easier access to capital and perhaps more engineers, stronger engineering schools closer to Kansas City that could provide software developers more of a sense of momentum from having a bunch of successful startups that had IPO'd, for example, those are really the key pieces, and that's harder to engineer.
Definitely, definitely. It is interesting because it's almost a story of a narrative that quickly built and spun out of control without all of the elements there to support it. It's so very interesting.
Yeah.
So everybody, head to Bloomberg.com and read the story. It is really wonderfully written and so very, very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today, Sarah McBride, reporter at Bloomberg.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. You know, when we were kids, we remember thinking about like what the future would be like, and it was very Jetsons-esque, wasn't it? Right? Well, the future is now, as I said before the break. Indeed, there is lots going on right now, just especially in the last couple of days. Chatter about Jeff Bezos, who is the chairman, founder, CEO, honcho guy there at Amazon, and also a company called Blue Origin that is space-focused. And he is really looking to expand beyond just this Earth and look to expand to the moon. So here to talk about that with us is Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport. Welcome to the program, Christian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me. So, you know, this is one of those headlines you look at it and you're like, what? How is that even a what? Huh? But nonetheless, Jeff Bezos has announced that he has this plan to set up something kind of like Amazon, like a cargo experience to serve the future human settlement on the moon. Please tell us about this.
Sure. It's called Blue Moon. As you mentioned, Blue Origin's the name of the company, and this proposal is called. His company circulated a paper to NASA and to the transition team that's taking over NASA as part of the Trump administration. And what Blue Origin and what a lot of different companies are doing, they're anticipating that NASA, which had been focused on Mars under the Obama administration, is going to pivot and then refocus on the moon. And so Bezos' company, Blue Origin, came up with this idea, which they presented to the NASA transition team, that said, hey, look, if you guys want to go to the moon, we can help you by delivering sort of the cargo, the supplies, the equipment, the infrastructure you would need to ultimately set up a human colony there. So they would be sort of the delivery service for solar power and habitats and science experiments and all of the stuff that you would need if you were going to put humans on the moon, not just to to visit, but to stay for some time. So that's what our story was about.
Fascinating. Well, so why do we think that shift is happening from Mars to Moon? Is this just about feasibility, since we know we can do that? We've been there, as Obama said earlier, when he shifted focus from the Moon to Mars, or is it something else?
No, I think that's exactly right. There are a few things. One, you know, we could go to the Moon. Mars is just really, really difficult. Even though that's been the focus of NASA for some time, it just seems as far away as ever. The plan to get there will get us there sometime in the mid-2030s, and it's not even clear that that timeline, you know, would be met by NASA. And with the Trump administration, I think they're coming in thinking, you know, this is something that they want to get done in a first term and sort of make a big splash. So there's sort of a political component to that as well. And it comes at a time when you've got a lot of these companies, like Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin, but also Elon Musk's SpaceX, that are making huge advancements with their rockets that they're building in-house. And so you're seeing sort of this technological revolution as well. But I think, yeah, I mean, the idea is, and sort of third part of all this is the thinking is that this wouldn't be just a mission to the moon where, like during the Apollo era in the late 60s, early 70s, where you had astronauts go there and leave what, you know, we call flags and footprints and then come home. But the idea here is that we would go to the moon and actually this time to stay. And there'd be a permanent presence there, sort of like how we now have on the International Space Station, where there are, you know, there's just a permanent human presence in space. But instead of being, you know, on the International Space Station, which is about 250 miles up, it'd be on the moon, which is 250,000 miles away.
You know, you mentioned these advances that have been happening, and I think perhaps unfairly, we hear a lot about SpaceX. Unfortunately, sometimes it is as a result of things not going well is when we hear about SpaceX. But nonetheless, it seems like we hear a little bit more about SpaceX than we do about Blue Origin. But in fact, there's some really interesting things that you point out in the story that everybody can go find at WashingtonPost.com about this this suborbital rocket, the New Shepard, that was launched successfully 5 times in the last year. And it flew just past, you know, the edge of space, and it was able to land vertically on a landing pad. And I think that's just kind of things this all seems very far-fetched, because I don't think we are necessarily hearing a lot about or grasping fully exactly how much they are doing.
Right. Well, so Blue Origin, you're right. They don't get nearly as much attention. That's in large part because they are much more secretive. SpaceX is just out there in the public eye so much more. They get so much more attention. And for years, Blue Origin, it's just been so secretive. I mean, I think people, even to this day, don't even realize that Jeff Bezos has a space company and that he's really, really serious about it. I mean, space is one of his real passions. But the way they approach it is he did finally, about a year ago, open up the headquarters to a few reporters, and I got to be one of them. And at one point, we asked him, you know, like, why are you sort of opening up now and talking about it? And he says, well, you know, we didn't want to talk about what we were doing until we've actually done something. And as you pointed out, they you know, in the last couple of years have actually started to do something. Now, what that is, as you mentioned, their New Shepard rocket, which is a suborbital rocket, which means it goes, you know, straight up and down. It doesn't, you know, enter the orbit of the Earth, which is, you know, sort of an order of magnitude more difficult, the orbital velocity. You have to be going extremely fast to do that. But that said, he was able to develop a rocket, shoot it up 62 miles, about 100 kilometers, what's considered the edge of space. But not just do that. I mean, the significant thing here was that the booster not just flew up, but then it flew back down and it was able to land. And then they flew that same rocket repeatedly, showing, you know, A, they had the technological ability to do it, but B, it's huge in terms of reusability. I mean, rockets are typically flown once and then thrown away. And, you know, as Jeff and others say, if, you know, it's like flying cross country on an airline from New York to California and then throwing the plane away. I mean, it'd just be so expensive, there'd be no commercial airlines. So he's trying to develop that technology to reuse the booster. And then that same technology, they hope, could be used on a lunar lander, where if they can, you know, land on a landing pad at their facility in West Texas, they could land on the South Pole of the Moon.
So interesting. All of this is so fascinating. Again, everybody, head to WashingtonPost.com and read about this story. It is really, really interesting and dives into much more detail than I'm afraid we can get into now in this small window of time that we have. But nonetheless, it is really interesting, kind of the new frontier of the space race is very, very interesting. So Christian Davenport, so thank you so much for being with us and sharing all of this with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you. All right, we are going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today, and thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Always most grateful to you for that. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots of headlines, lots of things. We're joined now by Ali Marati, a business reporter at Chicago Tribune. Always a pleasure to have Ali with us. And Ali, recently you wrote about this federal raid that happened at Caterpillar, which comes after years of scrutiny. But I think it still seemed rather surprising when we all kind of saw this in the headlines, except for, you know, people that have been following that story very, very closely. But I think to everyone else, it seemed like quite a shock. Tell us about how this all kind of came together.
Yeah, it was kind of a shock to executives there and to people who had been following it even. You know, I talked to somebody at an analyst at Morningstar who follows Caterpillar, and he said that, you know, even though the company has been disclosing these risks and these, like you said, these ongoing investigations on their annual reports, you know, the companies kind of list those risks like pharmaceuticals, risk side effects, you know, like
right.
Nobody really thinks that they're going to happen or develop into anything, But yeah, it's it started back in 2009 when a then employee of Caterpillar filed a whistleblower suit, alerting folks to this Swiss subsidiary that Caterpillar has, and basically Caterpillar had sort of done some paperwork back in the 90s actually that switched. This is a subsidiary that sells parts, and they had done some paperwork to make it so that they could avoid paying U.S. taxes basically. So it started with the whistleblower suit in 2009, and then in 2014, the Senate actually came out with a big investigation alleging that they had kind of gotten away with not paying $2.4 billion in U.S. taxes. And it's been going from there. The SEC has been watching them and other things, and it sort of all culminated on Thursday with this raid.
$2.4 billion, that's no small change.
No, not at all.
That's quite a bit. And so what is next for Caterpillar? What happens now? I mean, what are the immediate steps that happen both from the corporate side of that and then for the federal authorities who did the raid? What occurs now for timeline wise?
Yeah. So the IRS has proposed.
Uh-oh, did we lose you?
Area.
Oh, there you are. Okay.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. So the IRS has proposed to tax some of those profits made from that subsidiary and impose a penalty, which is $2 billion. And Caterpillar's been fighting that, so that fight's still ongoing. And then, you know, like I said, the executives at Caterpillar said they were taken by surprise by this raid, and they're saying that they're going to cooperate with the authorities moving forward. And now what else the investigation will include, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it as they progress.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, right here in our backyard with that Caterpillar headquarters being right there in Peoria. And so what do we think that, you know, what did that look like for, you know, for employees, for, you know, shareholders, for, you know, all the people that have stake, either officially or unofficially, you know, in the company? What's the feeling there now?
Yeah, well, there was a shareholder that filed a class action suit on Friday right after the raid, alleging that, you know, executives had misled shareholders and caused sort of a dip in the stocks, which is true. The stock did dip on Thursday in response to the raid, but Friday it was back up. It hadn't fully recovered. I talked to a couple branding experts, and they said that it seems like, at least in the short term, Caterpillar is going to emerge from this. Their brand and their reputation is going to emerge from this largely unscathed. And part of that is because they have such a strong brand that's been around for so long. You know, they're typically good corporate citizens. They have really great employee loyalty. So there's that. And then back in January, Caterpillar announced that it was moving, it planned to move its headquarters up to the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. They haven't said where yet. So we've been seeing, you know, different suburbs and counties surrounding Cook County kind of trying to vie for their attention. And I DuPage County is an example, and Naperville is also an example. And I talked to executives from our officials in those two places, and they both said the sentiment hasn't changed. They still want Caterpillar to come set up shop in their areas. So it's kind of interesting to see what's happening. We have some upset shareholders, but then largely the brand doesn't seem to have suffered too much.
That's so interesting because, you know, you think about something, such a scandalous thing happening, right? Any brand, we've talked about many of them right here on the show, but you think about that happening and you think, well, they're done. And for some, right. And for some, that is the case. So it is really interesting to see this, you know, potential resilience on display for a brand like Caterpillar. Well, we will keep turning to you, of course, as ever, at Chicago Tribune to keep us updated on this and all the timeline, you know, milestones to come about this. So thank you so much for being with us today, Ali Marotti.
Sure thing. Anytime.
All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, still tons to talk about here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking about the business side of Northwestern sports right now because there's a lot to that, a lot more than you might think. So back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and sharing part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful to you for that. So we've been talking a whole lot about Northwestern basketball here on this station, as we do, right? Mr. Wildcat and all. We have been doing that. But you know what? This is the Business Lunch show. And so there's also a lot to talk about there as we think of the business side of things in the sports world generally, but right here as it pertains to Northwestern. Joining us now to talk about that is Danny Ecker, sports reporter at Cranes Chicago. Hey, Danny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Amy.
Always a pleasure to have you on with us. So as we look to the business side of things at Northwestern, what is really on the forefront there? What are the big pieces to consider?
Well, you know, it's really in this case the timing of Northwestern surging really on the basketball court and having this really probably the best season in the program's history is perfect. If you sketch out, first of all, if you sketch out the big revenue sources for athletic departments, in this case, Northwestern, you know, the TV revenue for that the Big Ten distributes is the big, big bucket, way bigger than anything else that any of the teams draw from ticket sales or sponsorships. But and that's something that the teams, you know, that Northwestern basketball team doesn't really have much of an impact on. But the ticket sales and the sponsorship money, those are revenue sources that allow them to, you know, to distribute that into other sports and distribute that into the program. And those things are significant pieces of the puzzle for them. So it's just they're in a really good position right now to cash in through some higher ticket sales and especially through redesigning Welsh Ryan Arena, which they're about to do to take advantage of the fact that they're on the verge of making their first ever NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to say that because I know, boy, listeners jump on me about, you know, jinxing things. But, you know, but sure, it's such a promising time for them for sure. So let's talk about that arena a little bit, because that's a $110 million overhaul. Then that's starting right around the corner.
Yeah, so this thing was way, way overdue, first of all. You know, Welsh Ryan Arena, 64 years old, you know, really has not seen huge facelifts. It's got little tweaks here and there, a new scoreboard and things like that. Anyone who's ever been to a Northwestern basketball game in the last, you know, 60 years can tell you how uncomfortable, in addition to how bad the basketball has been for the most part, it's how uncomfortable the seats are. I mean, you have, especially in the upper deck areas, it's a pretty uncomfortable place to watch a game. Although it is a great atmosphere because, you know, it's kind of this old school type of basketball arena that you're right on top of the court. But what they're doing, this $110 million renovation, which was mostly made possible by who else? Aon founder Pat Ryan, who has put his name on almost every other building at Northwestern. You know, they are completely redoing. I mean, really gutting the building and redoing it with New center scoreboard, video boards around the building, much better seating, more comfortable seating. Actually, the capacity is going to drop a little bit. They're going to have actually fewer seats because the seats are going to be physically bigger. And, you know, it's just going to be a much more really just sort of business-friendly in a lot of ways arena, although I think they're going to try to really maintain that sense of, you know, it's still an old-school feel to it. And really what that does for Northwestern is that that allows them to, you know, reseat all their season ticket holders. And when the interest in the team is as high as it is right now, you know, you can actually raise some season ticket prices, and you can actually require maybe even donations to be able to get season tickets. And that's something that, you know, that that the school is most likely going to try to do to kind of cash in on this winning period.
Definitely. And, you know, I think that sponsor piece is one that's often overlooked. We talk so much about ticket prices and season ticket holders and that as being this big revenue piece. But to bring a sponsor to a game with, you know, a small and not the most comfortable seat, is, you know, that's a very different experience than taking a sponsor to a game in this, you know, newly renovated space with very comfortable seats and,
right,
you know, lots of cool, you know, banners and technology options before their eyes. That's a very different experience, as you point out.
And not only that, but, you know, the other thing about Northwestern, as most people know who have been to Northwestern, you know, when they're playing, you know, conference games against other major Big Ten schools, is that usually the opposing school's fans outnumber the Northwestern fans. And that's also been, if you talk to people who have sold those sponsorships on behalf of Northwestern in previous years, you know, you take a potential corporate partner to a game and, you know, they're playing, Northwestern's playing Illinois, and you look in the crowd at a Northwestern home game and it's mostly orange. That's a tough sell when you're trying to make that sale to a you know, someone who's going to invest in that in the program and realizing, okay, well, who's even following this? You know, what do I know I'm getting here? So, it's a big deal to be able to you know, have this successful run and to actually show that there's a lot of support out there as long as the team is, you know, putting out a good product.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you point out something really interesting in the story that you wrote about this at ChicagoBusiness.com, and that is about how Northwestern, when asked about this, points to a long focus on making some strategic decisions for the long haul. And it seems like they're talking about a lot more than just let's build a new space. It seems like they're kind of talking about some things that have been in the works for a very long time. If you, with hindsight, if you had to look back, kind of what were those key decisions in your mind that have, you know, led to not just the team success, but the business and the financial success of the team right now?
Yeah, well, it started with Jim Phillips, who's the athletic director, who came on 2008, 2009, around there. You know, really took a totally separate approach from the previous athletic director, Mark Murphy, who's now the president of the Green Bay Packers. You know, really looking at it and saying, okay, we need to tap into, from a strategic standpoint, tap into the Chicago market and make people, you know, even if Northwestern's not their favorite team, maybe it's their next favorite team. Maybe they root for their alma mater, but, you know, Northwestern's a Chicago area team and they want to get them on board. That, from a strategic standpoint, was what Jim Phillips set in place. And to do so, he made a lot of big hires and they had some big investments. They first of all, one of the biggest things they did is they started putting together a ticket selling staff. They had no sort of outbound ticket sales staff before Jim Phillips got there. You know, now they have about a dozen people who are, you know, really reaching out, developing relationships with season ticket holders. That was just not something that was a priority before Jim Phillips came along. They also developed the Chicago's Big Ten team mantra that many people maybe have heard of. Maybe they have an opinion on it one way or the other, whether they like it or not. But, you know, they've now committed to that campaign for 7 years. And I think the result is that have raised their profile, at least in the Chicago area, which is very tough to do because there are a lot of sports competition, competition for the entertainment dollar on the sports scene, very crowded market. The ticket sales staff and really just Jim Phillips setting out to make Northwestern a bigger deal in this massive pond of Chicago, a little bit bigger fish, even though they are still relatively small, you know, that's gone a long way for them. So, you know, a lot of pieces like that, and I think they're still not done with, you know, kind of reiterating that brand. And, of course, what you have to do to really seize it is to put out good teams on the field. And when you look at some of the success they've had in football and some of the success now they're having in basketball, That's helping kind of all the structure they built on sort of on the back end, on the business side, really helping that come to fruition.
Definitely. And I really think it's so interesting to watch how they have really diversified that kind of revenue, even not writing off the young alumni, whereas I think a lot of schools put such major focus on long past alumni who probably has a little bit deeper pockets. I think Northwestern has done a pretty good job of really including recent and young alumni in that conversation, because those small donations, of course, add up now and certainly pad things out, but that just kind of builds that relationship for later. So that's very, very interesting to watch.
Yeah, it was one of those points we brought up in the story, too, which is that, we were talking to Mike Gordon, who's the president of the Chicago Wolves minor league hockey team, and he used to be on the business side of DePaul for their athletic department. He was saying how that was a big deal to kind of get young alumni, even if they're donating $10,
yeah.
$10 a year, great, because if they get in the habit of doing that every year, by the time maybe they have some more resources and means, and then you can have that conversation 25, 30 years down the road, you build that pipeline of donors, young donors, maybe it's a little easier to have that conversation when you're asking them for maybe to write some bigger checks and maybe endow certain things. And, Northwestern has seen that with some trustees. I mean, look at some of the things they did. They sold an endowment to the head coach, Chris Collins. He's now the Sullivan Ubbin head coach. Named after a couple of trustees who put $3 million up for the athletic department and said, okay, you put our names on the coaches, naming rights to the coaches position, essentially. And they've done the same thing with Pat Fitzgerald's coach, with his official name, on the football side. So, little things that they're able to do to bring in more money, and they're starting to put that into a lot of, new, better facilities that are really required now to be a major college sports program.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we will keep turning to you at Cranes Chicago for all the latest. And thanks so much for being with us today, Danny Ecker.
Thanks a lot.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news here in a bit and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN.